For the week of October 18th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 515, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Halloween Town, I'm Michael Giltz.
I don't even know where... Oh, Halloween Town. Isn't that like Nightmare Before Christmas or Christmas Before the Nightmare, and the Nightmare had that...
It's the number two movie in North America.
Oh, that's why you're bringing it up.
Okay. Well, maybe it is number two. I shouldn't say that. I'm not actually sure where it is on the charts. But yeah, it opened up this weekend, paired with Hocus Pocus. It was at the drive-in, and I didn't go. But
what?
It was on the Disney Channel in a loop, because we're coming up to Halloween. And there it was on TV, and I was like, I really do want to go, because it's a cool-looking movie, great score. It's just a fun, very specific. I love stop motion animation. Terrific song start to finish. Really makes me want to go see it again.
You know, I remember seeing it in theaters as a Tim Burton film when it first came out
in
the 90s.
It's not. It's a Henry Selick film.
Oh, you're right. He produced it, right? Tim Burton.
That's correct. Yeah, it's Tim Burton's. And they branded it with Tim Burton because they wanted to bring in more people. But it's Henry Selick, who's a terrific director.
Yeah. Now, I did not get a chance to see these Halloween favorites because I was too busy at the AFI Fest, which is still taking place. This is the AFI Film Festival. It takes place every autumn in, you know, Los Angeles, really. Usually in person, almost always in person, except for this week, or this year, I should say, thanks to the pandemic. But you know what? AFI has been able to pull it off. They got their sponsor Audi back, and they're pulling off a film festival, and it's virtual, but I have been watching movies.
It's going well.
Yeah, and I have to say, their Eventive, I think, is the platform that they're on, and it is really good. I've watched 76 Days, which was also in Toronto. It's a documentary about what happened in Wuhan over 76 days, starting January 23rd, and then, of course, going through the 76 days until they reopened. And it takes place inside a Red Cross hospital, and they kind of follow these, which is really hard to do because everybody's wearing these gowns. You have no idea who is who. In fact, all of the doctors and nurses, they all have their names written on them, but of course they're in Chinese, so of course you can't tell who anybody is. But it's a fascinating look at how the virus and the pandemic started and how it was handled in China. I also saw Shadow in the Cloud, starring Chloe Grace Moretz as a World War II pilot.
Fighting. Oh, that sounds like it's really fun, isn't it?
It is kind of fun. What's really interesting about it is that she spends most of the time in the turret, in the bottom turret of this bomber. And so most of the film takes place in this turret. It's pretty remarkable.
As Gremlins attack.
Yes. Literally, I read someplace, I think it was Kate Erbland in IndieWire that said that film, Shadow in the Cloud, is like a Hollywood pitch meeting gone awry. They just throw everything in it. You know, action film? Sure. Monster film? Sure. Horror film? Sure. War film? Absolutely. Throw that in too. You know,
it's female empowerment? Got it.
Yeah, sprinkle that over the... Oh, yeah. It's very, very... that was fun. And then I'm trying to think what else. Oh, I saw Whirly Bird, which... You want to talk about an interesting documentary about the start of kind of these aerial, I don't know, news gathering. One of the guys who kind of bought a helicopter, Bob Turr, and his wife, Marika, and they kind of started, you know, car chasing. You know, they literally would do car chases. And he was the guy who found the O.J. Simpson white Bronco. And he's the guy, and that team filmed the Reginald Denny riot. You know, in 1992, that was his footage of Reginald Denny getting beaten up during the riots. It's a fascinating documentary, if only for historical purposes, obviously.
Well, cool. So you've had a good fest.
Yeah, and it continues to go. It keeps going.
Well, so does Henry Selick, by the way, to point out that while that is not a Tim Burton film, he is producing it. The Nightmare Before Christmas was his film debut, followed by James and the Giant Peach, a terrific musical with a great Randy Newman score, an animated film, Monkey Bone, which was a flop, and then Coraline, which is a masterpiece and one of the few films that uses 3D well. That was back in 2009. It's been 12 years since he's had a new film, but he is making a film with Key and Peele called Wendell and Wild about two scheming demons taking on an evil nun. That comes out hopefully in 2021. So he's had a great track record. You know, three out of his first four films have been very good to great. They've all been on my best of the year list. And Coraline is just a gorgeous film based on a great novel. So Henry Selick is a major talent, and I can't wait to see what he does next. But tell me, what are we going to talk about on the show this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are cheering the fact that most cinemas in New York State will reopen at least a little. Okay. We're delighted to see The Nightmare Before Christmas back on the big screen, as you just
mentioned. What's this? Keep going.
Okay, yeah, you really have to see the film to get that. Yeah, anyway, those songs, by the way, in that movie are so catchy that they're worthy of BTS, and the Korean boy band's management company just launched its IPO. We're also counting the days until David Byrne's show opens back on Broadway a year from now.
Can I be your guest?
At the rate we're going, I'd like to actually hear from the Hudson Theater and or the people that sold me the tickets for, I think it's January. I don't know when I originally had tickets. Obviously, they're no good anymore.
If your wife can't make it, I'm available.
Well, I'll keep that in mind. I wonder.
Ditto for the Music Man.
if that thing ever takes off. But in any case, we'll be talking about, I guess the Tony nominations, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's Disney, of course. We can't forget Disney. Okay. So on Inside Baseball, by the way, we will be looking at the Mouse House. Again, we did it last week. We'll do it again this week, but for completely different reasons. The company officially announced a restructuring to refocus the company's content creation on streaming. And then they will also focus on streaming with a side of streaming. Okay, so in case you were wondering where that company's headed. Now, is this a hasty pivot, long in the works, or just kind of making official the obvious? Or is it just kind of a company restructuring under a new leader? You know what? We'll find out. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office. I cannot wait to see what you have coming up, because I can tell you, I have no idea where you're pulling some of these films from.
Well, there's some great news all over the world, from Japan, from China, not so much in Europe yet. Korea is feeling a little slow, but the lights are on around the world. If you've got a movie and you're not worried about it being completely ripped off by pirates, you know, regional releases are the way to go. We're looking at the box office around the world for the week ending October 18th. And the number one movie around the world, again, is My People, My Homeland, that patriotic documentary in China that grossed another $45 million. It's at $366 million worldwide. And let me say right now, I really miss ComScore. It's nice to have one consistent source of information. We know they do a good job, but this week we're pulling information from everywhere. And Deadline disagrees with Variety, which disagrees with the international report on Box Office Mojo or The Prophet, which disagrees with what you're finding on Wikipedia, which pulls their info from the numbers. I'm really not sure about some of these totals, but my assumption is if someone says that a movie has hit a certain number and it's bigger than someone else, I'm figuring out they have more recent numbers or have pulled information from somewhere that other person isn't. They're pulling from, say, worldwide info. So some people had My People, My Homeland a little lower, but I saw $366 million. So that's what we're going with. We're doing the best we can. But that made $45 million this week. It's still on fire. China is doing very well. It's post, the Golden Week and Nation Day, but people are still heading to the movies. At number two, very good news, Japan. The number one movie in Japan and the second biggest movie around the world is Demon Slayer, the movie Mugen Train or Infinity Train. I really should have looked up the pronunciation of Mugen. I apologize for that. But this is a film that opened up in Japan. It's an anime. It made $44 million. That's the biggest opening of all time in Japan. Japan just had its biggest opening of all time. China just had a huge nation week with a lot of people going to the movies. God willing, there won't be any reports down the weeks or months of cluster spreading from that. So far, the news is good. Oh, it would take 2 weeks anyway. But so far, so good. They've been open for a little while now. Japan, its biggest opening of all time. Coming out of the pandemic, it dominated like 85% of the entire box office this week. It's a film based on a manga which was turned into an animated TV series, The manga's one of the best-selling mangas of all time. It's sold more than 100 million copies. It's about a kid who becomes a demon slayer when his family is slaughtered and his sister is turned into a demon, though he seems to be protecting her and keeping her safe when not letting her kill him.
I hate it when that happens.
I know. And believe me, I feel like some of my siblings have turned into demons. But anyway.
He's in town all week, ladies and gentlemen.
Now it's a film. And again, with very good reviews. So this has been a high quality project from start to finish. It's coming out in North America next year, fingers crossed. I'm very much looking forward to seeing it. So that is a big news. A movie set a all-time record coming out of the pandemic. That's certainly something to take courage from.
Now, I wonder that if the fact that there are no Hollywood movies at all the marketplace helped that become the biggest opener.
I think
that it's popular. It's a popular title.
Well, I think it's you know, six of one. It doesn't help when there aren't movies out because people are not in the habit of going to the movies. So it's not great to be the only movie in town. See Tenet. Tenet would have done better if the box office was fully open in North America and people have been going to the movies every week. I believe crowds have rejected the movie and they don't actually like it and it's not getting good word of mouth in the U.S. I think that's clear that it's its least scoring film since Inception or whatever, maybe Interstellar, I forget. But it's not getting great audience response, but there's no doubt it would have made a lot more than $50 million if it had opened up in normal times. So it cuts both ways. We're not going to
If it had opened in normal times, it would have made $50 million in its opening weekend.
Oh,
and then
easily.
Probably
no,
trailed
more than
off.
That. Right, exactly. But it would have definitely made a lot more money. So Demon Slayer, it has some advantages. There's definitely a lot of negatives as well to being out there when there's nothing else open and nothing going on and people haven't been in the habit of going to the movies. So given its great track record as one of the best-selling mangas, terrific reviews for the TV series, terrific reviews for the movie. I think the movie's doing exactly what it should have, and perhaps it would have lifted up the other movies around it and helped them do better. So maybe it's not, you know, benefiting. Maybe it's the other movies could have helped out. You know, they would have enjoyed the backwash from my Demon Slayer movie. Anyway, I don't think we need to put an asterisk by that. That's an accomplishment no matter what. I don't care if there's no movies open. Your movie opens, everybody goes, that's a win. At number three around the world is another Chinese film, Leap, the volleyball film starring Gong Li. Another $16 million. That's now at $115 million worldwide. That looks like it's great news. Given the type of film it is, I'm sure it's a winner already. But I haven't been able to figure out the budget. If you know, call us.
Yes, you can call us. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You know, we're also on Twitter. We're @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can like our page. Now, I'm wondering, Michael, you said that this film Leap made $16 million. I'm seeing here on the China Ent Group that it made 10.6.
No, remember, we're looking at the total week score.
Yeah, 10.6 from 10-12 to 10-18. That's what, 7 days? Yeah. 6 days?
Well, it's also in other territories.
Ah, okay.
It's
good
not
point.
Just playing in China.
Got it.
But yes, what we do is we take the total box office.
Okay.
From this week, whatever's reported as the highest box office, we subtract last week's. And then that's where we go. But I believe Leap is playing in a few other territories. Don't hold me to that.
In which
but
case
whatever,
that makes
you know,
sense.
That last week, its total box office was $99 million. Now it's up. What did they say the total box office is this week?
In China alone. Okay. So China only, 10.6.
No, total box office.
Oh, total box office?
Yeah. What has it made to date?
To date, it has made 137. I don't know. I'd have to find out.
No. What are you looking at?
I'm looking at the China Ent Group, which...
Ent Group, well, so am I. Leap made 109.7 cumulative gross. See that next to the 10.6? You'll find 109.7 is its cumulative gross.
Okay. Wow.
Right? However, when you look on the international roundup for Deadline, you will find that its total box office right now, they claim, is $115 million. So I'm believing it made $5 million in a few other minor territories that aren't included in that China roundup. So that's why I said, okay, $115 looks like the total box office. I'm sure they didn't just throw in an extra $5 million for fun. So that's how we do that right now. We take the worldwide box office for this week, subtract last week's, and that's the money it made. So if you're wondering, you can check out our link to the Ent group and their stuff in our show notes. They're there every week. So if you ever have questions about how we're doing the math or where we're getting this information from, we usually try to tell you, but there's always links in our show notes. Sperling does that work every week. Back to the box office. At number four around the world is the animated film Jiang Ziya, which is the follow-up to Noja. And it's clearly not being wildly embraced by fans, but hey, it still made a good amount of money. This week it made $11 million. It's at $217 million worldwide. Tenet also made $11 million. It's at $335 million worldwide. Then that comedy in China, it's still going, it's building up some steam. Coffee or Tea, of the movie about three pals going into business together. It's made another $11 million. It's at $33 million and counting. So now that audiences have found it, they seem to like it. The War with Grandpa, the De Niro film, that's doing okay. That made $7 million this week worldwide. It's at $11 million and counting. Back to China, another new film. It's The Story of Xibao. That made $7 million. It looks like a weepy drama of some sort. Watching the trailer, I thought it was about a woman who sacrificed love to marry into wealth. But the description of the novel it's based on says it's about an adopted son who falls hard for his sister. Oops, a little Clueless action there. So that's that movie. I'm not sure what it's about, even looking at the trailer and reading about the book it's based on. But it opened up in China. It's post the big week where a lot of big movies opening up. So it made $7 million. We don't know the budget. Now, finally, something from North America. Honest Thief, the new film starring Liam Neeson. Very much like all the other action movies from Liam Neeson. That's what the reviews say. It made $5 million on its opening week. Jackie Chan is still churning them out. He made $4 million this week. His movie Vanguard is at $38 million. That toxic teen romance movie, After We Collided, it's opening up soon in North America. It's at about $46 million worldwide. And then The 800 made another $3 million. Greenland, the Gerard Butler film, that's coming to North America on demand pretty quickly. That's at $31 million. Mulan made another $2 million. That is at $70 million worldwide. And since Disney isn't talking about how well it did on demand, we're going to assume that that premium on demand offer of $30 was not snapped up by a lot of people. And then The Nightmare Before Christmas. That's a great movie. It's at $90 million, which doesn't sound like a lot for a stop motion animated film, but its reported budget is just $18 million. So that movie was a winner even on its first release, and it's been coming out year after year ever since.
Well, you know, you flew by the Liam Neeson thing without letting me get my joke in about the reason the film is doing so well.
Why is it doing so well?
Because he can, Liam Neeson has, particular set of skills and skills that he has acquired over a long career. In fact,
it's all about timing. It's all about timing.
Because that joke could have been so much better when you mentioned.
So we don't have any info on Korean box office this week. I don't have any movies that have seemed to have broken out there. I'm sure the box office is open, but it's been sort of not doing great, much like North America. And one word from cinema owners is that they are raising ticket prices. That doesn't sound like a great idea to me, but they are raising prices from 80 cents to $1.80, roughly, depending on the time of day and all that. So they're going to be about $11 to buy a ticket in Korea right now. When people aren't going to the movies, raising ticket prices seems kind of like the opposite of what you should be doing.
Yeah, well, it's the same with restaurants here. Now, where are they raising prices? In Korea or here in the U.S.?
In Korea.
Yeah. Okay,
Korea.
That makes sense because here, of course, they're lowering ticket prices.
I don't think it makes sense. I think it's a bad idea. I'm saying raising ticket prices when people are scared to go back to the movies and are wary and are not showing up. You raise prices when movies are in high demand and everybody wants to see your big new film with, 3D glasses. Then you bump up the ticket prices, not when people are staying away. That's not a way to bring in business. Well, we'll charge $1,000 a ticket. That doesn't work that way.
Well, I don't know. I'd be interested to note whether and figure out whether there has been any kind of fall off on attendance in Korea, because they never really did close their cinemas fully.
Well, they're stumbling along, and that's why and ticket sales are not strong, and that's why the one report I had says they are raising ticket prices. So yes, it's not doing well. The attendance is not ever catching fire again. Clearly, even though they never shut down, they weren't having people packing in the theaters. It's not like they were happy-go-lucky the whole time. So the U.S. box office is open, and the number one movie grossed $3 million. We're open 80% of the market, but so what? So it's not good. But China box office, we talked about the figures and how hard it is to get a good a good number from everybody and trying to reconcile all these different figures. Some people say, like Variety, that the Chinese box office has now officially passed the North American box office and they are the number one market around the world. That's for this year. Will it continue next year? Who knows? But right now, Variety says they're $1.98 billion versus $1.93 billion. They've made $2 billion, both of them, and it's October. In comparison, in 2019, North America hit $11 billion and China hit $9 billion for the entire year. So you can see how far we have fallen. But Deadline says, no, 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 they're not right. China's still a little bit ahead. Or, I mean, US is a little bit ahead and China hasn't caught up yet, though they will in a week or two. So
yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's pretty much inevitable since we're, we're releasing nothing. Okay, the US is releasing nothing right now. Okay, Europe is doing quite well with some of its local content, which is really good.
And Japan just had great news. But I'm just shocked that Variety and Deadline are not working from the same numbers, that everybody can't agree on what the total box office is in North America and in China.
Especially since they're owned by the same company. They're all the same. Yeah, I mean,
you're right. Well, we do know one thing, don't we? AMC is running out of cash.
That is true. And we are not talking about AMC, the network that produced Mad Men. No, we are talking about AMC, the movie theater chain here in the US, which, by the way, owns the Nordic Cinema Group in Scandinavia and Odeon in the EU and in the UK. And they are basically saying, look, warning. And they did this in a filing. They didn't come out and say, hey, press release, we're running out of money. No, they are basically saying, if we can't reopen and we don't have Hollywood content, big blockbusters that bring in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, we're going to run out of money. Okay.
And by when?
By the end of the year.
Yeah, they said, but in 10 weeks, they may run out of money, or at best, early 2021, they may need to declare bankruptcy. And they said, they mean the real kind, right?
What do you mean the real kind? Like, you mean
there's kinds where you declare bankruptcy so you can, negotiate with people and restructure things and get back to business in a better financial footing. And there's actual real bankruptcy where you're like, we're done, we're out. We've lost.
Yeah,
it's over.
Like, say, in the U.S., Borders Bookstore, where they said, we're declaring bankruptcy, we're giving up all of our leases, we're selling all of our inventory, and then after that's over, we're going on vacation because we are not reopening at all. Unlike, say, there's a gym company, basically a fitness company here in the U.S. called 24 Hour Fitness. They operate, gyms and health clubs.
And sometimes you make a financial decision to declare bankruptcy so you can get out from the debt and restructure and renegotiate and all that.
And they basically said, look, we're doing this to get out of leases, long-term leases in clubs that make no sense. They were very open about it.
So this is scary. AMC is running out of cash. And in a related note, Universal and Warner Brothers, when asked, said, no, we have no plans to buy cinema chains. But are you going to, how about what do you call that? We need vertical integration, buddies. Come on. And in another related note, Paramount has sold Coming to America. The sequel to the original Coming to America, now called Coming to America, has been sold to Amazon for $125 million. They're like, we can't release it theatrically, so we're selling to Amazon. As far as I can tell, and it was unclear in the stories, there will not be a theatrical release, but it's not absolutely clear to me. Maybe there will be some sort of limited theatrical release, or maybe they'll be happy to have it released everywhere as long as chains are willing to show it, knowing it'll be on Amazon a week or two later. So that's not clear to me, but it isn't a good sign. The good sign is that global cinema chains begged New York Governor Cuomo to please reopen cinemas. They made a specific plea again, joining in with the American cinemas. What happened? The first good news we have.
I think Andrew Cuomo looked at a map and went, oh my God, Buffalo is nowhere near New York City. You just figured that out because you literally have closed down movie theaters in all of New York State, which stretches from New York City all the way to basically Ohio. And so we said, you know what? Okay, we will let movie theaters open up every place but New York City because we're trying to control certain outbreaks within the city.
Numbers are rising in half the country, in a lot of the country. So we can all pillory the New York governor all we want. But when people die, you'll yell at him again for opening too soon. So I agree. I see the frustration of cinemas. I recognize it. I see the information they seem to be providing from around the world. I see the stuff that the airlines are providing going, that doesn't hold up. They're like, well, it works great if you sit in your seat and keep your mask on and never move around. You're like, well, that's not how people fly.
Yeah.
And the longer you're in a plane, the more problem it is. But anyway, they're opening up.
By the way, this week. Look at Celluloid Junkie today. There is a post on Celluloid Junkie written by Patrick Von Sikowski, who was our guest just a week or two ago, about no COVID-19 transmissions or, yeah, there have been none traced back to cinemas, including that 31 million, kind of involuntary study that South Korea did, because of course they're tracking everything based on cell phones. And there have been,
no super spreader events. That's great.
They did track back, I think a certain number of people who had COVID-19 when they went to the cinema, as they found out later. And yet even there, when they traced the people in the cinema at the same time, they went, wow, none of these people caught COVID from it. We thought for sure that would happen. Didn't happen. 31 million people.
Tell me a question. You launched this podcast years ago, a long time ago, and I joined like a few episodes in, but I wasn't there at the start. Why didn't you call this podcast Celluloid Junkie?
It was a totally different,
wanted to be broader.
Broader. Yeah. We wanted music. We wanted television. We wanted streaming.
Theater.
Yeah. And theater, books we cover. If I could just rewind a couple beats, we talked about AMC. We talked about Universal and Warner Brothers saying they have no plans on buying
cinema. Paramount selling off a movie to streamer.
Okay. So let's talk about Universal and Warner Brothers first. So last Tuesday, I started getting on some calls and exhibitors were expressing some concern. They said, funny this, you're not giving us content. You're not supplying us with product so that we can sell it for you. Meanwhile, you're still able to make revenue. We're all going to go under at a time when you're now all of a sudden allowed to buy us out. So
yeah.
Isn't that ironic? Isn't that interesting? So Universal...
And they said, no.
Universal,
we have no interest.
Warner Brothers immediately said, whoa, that is not what we are doing. Then on Thursday, I moderated the opening keynote of Expo Cine in Brazil, which my Portuguese was very rough at the beginning, then I had to switch to English. But I interviewed John Fithian, the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, for 1 hour. And to say that I ran out of questions is an understatement. I thought it was like a 30-minute thing. No, it went on for an hour. One of my questions was about, do you think that this is what's going on? That you have...
But there's a secret plot by studios to let them go under so they can buy them out? I would say no. I'd feel safe with that. Doesn't mean they wouldn't buy them out if the opportunity arose.
He pointed out that, look, first of all, Disney could have bought a theater chain whenever they wanted. They were never a part of the Paramount consent decree. So they could have done that years ago. And frankly, Netflix could, bought one or two theaters for their own films. He pointed to maybe not studios buying them out, but he said, if it's going to happen, and I'm thinking it's probably not, he said, I would err on the side of this is not going to happen because it would have happened already. Apple or Amazon or one of these streamers coming along, because frankly, they have so much money that buying out a theater chain for $2.1 or $3.1 billion is peanuts compared to buying out Whole Foods for $14 billion.
Apple doesn't have enough movies to fill up, an hour's worth of showtime on their channel. So they don't have any content to show in a movie theater.
No, but Amazon being a retailer, I could see that.
Right. Well, that's why Netflix has bought a few cinemas, isn't it? So they can showcase their movies. But I don't think they see the advantage in having a whole chain. I think they're wrong. It's a good business. If they see themselves as content providers and vertical integration is allowed again, which it shouldn't be. But since it is, to me, it's a very efficient way of doing things.
Well, you know what I could actually see happening is, we're not exactly running you into shore because we want to scoop you up and come in as your savior. Instead, we wouldn't mind if you ran into shore and your boat broke up and everybody else took pieces of you, because then all of a sudden you go from owning, a huge chunk of the market into smaller pieces that are a little bit easier.
Well, it's more likely to be gobbled up by the other big chains. The big ones are going to get bigger. It's not going to get smaller. It's better to have more competition. And that's if the AMC and others are hurt, that does not help the big studios. They'd rather negotiate with three and four people to play off each other. You've already got half the market is small people.
Yeah.
So they don't want it to get even more one company dominating. So I don't think that helps them.
Coming to America, however, if you look at that, Paramount Okay. Mm-hmm. They have no revenue right now coming in on the studio side, $0.
Right. So now they made the movie and they made a little bucks.
Yeah. You look at Coming to America, you say $125 million, all cash, all in. You know what? Yep. Could they have made that money?
Worldwide box office? Sure.
I don't know that they own that film worldwide. They may only own it in the US, but maybe let's just say they own and it made $500 million. When is that money coming in?
Takes a while.
Yeah, it takes a while as opposed to getting a check for $125. That's a bird in the hand right there.
The first movie made $300 million a long time ago, you know.
32 years or something like that.
Yeah. So that's a long time ago. The sequel, we don't know the budget of it.
Right. And so, you know what? Maybe they're only buying it for the US Amazon. So
I don't know that.
I don't know either.
Yeah, I did not see anything about, it was going to be theatrically released, but Amazon, you know, it just says it.
And it wasn't
American rights. Yeah. It just says, you know, everywhere. So I think it's worldwide. Amazon doesn't buy stuff for territory by territory too much.
No.
Right. So this is good news for cinemas. They're open up again in New York State, except for the city. They've got the usual restrictions, and it'll shut back down again if things don't work. Good news in the UK. The UK has launched its insurance fund, a $650 million fund to cover losses from delays and shutdowns due to the coronavirus. Movies and TV shows can't get insurance, so they're wary of opening back up to production because, right, as you've seen, they open up, they shut down, they open up again. It's been happening multiple times on multiple shows. Well, now in the UK, they're allowing people to do that with a little tweak in the rules and a little insurance funding coming direct from the government.
That's actually happening here in the US as well and around the world. Mm-hmm. Studios, however, are self-insuring. They're basically saying, nope, we're going to take the loss if that happens. We can't get insurance, so we'll just have to self-insure. Independents, however,
they can't do that.
They can't do that, yeah.
Right. And there are stuff being made. Reboots of Buck Rogers, reboots of Dexter, reboots of Fried Green Tomatoes, a TV series that's going to star Reba McEntire instead of the movie in the book. It's going to become a TV show.
Great. So, now I'm hungry. Know, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Hollywood is going back to the tried and the true. But at UTA, hey, Sperling, did you get a promotion this week?
I did not get a promotion. I know.
What?
I know they
UTA, they upped 19 agents. It's the biggest class ever becoming an agent at one time.
What do you mean? Just last week, I thought we had 26. We talked about this last week, didn't we?
I thought it was another company.
Oh, now yeah, maybe. UTA. I've lost track of all these people. They're, you know, first of all, first,
you're an agent. You get to be an agent.
First, they fire all the older agents because they're making too much money. And then they, you know, kind of promote all the mailroom people because, hey, you know what? You're not making as much money as that guy we just laid off.
Exactly. Well, there you go. I think it's a big deal. I'm very excited. You know, a lot of new agents. People are making movies. New York State gets to open back up. I think it's a good time. And I think, you know what? I think that means it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop. That's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Sperling, what's our first story?
Our first story is that Michael does not trust me to make a transition from the previous segment into our weekly segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, so much so that he actually took over the transition midway through. I think that's actually
good. Lord.
Anyway, you know what? It was a bad week. Big deal or big... No, okay, actually, it was a bad week for C-SPAN's Steve Scully, that's for sure. He was supposed to be moderating a presidential debate. Instead, Scully was watching town halls on two different channels, kind of hard to do that, by the way, and being suspended for lying about a tweet. Okay, Twitter gets more people fired, I swear. Anyway, like so many media figures, Scully was being attacked by the right for supposed biases against Trump. He says the attacks included his family and that the final straw was when Trump attacked Scully by name. Scully sent a direct message via tweet to Anthony Scaramucci asking for advice on how to respond. However, instead of a DM, Scully posted it as a tweet. Dude,
Oopsie.
Really need to put your kids in charge of your social media, okay? Because you are not cutting it. When he realized his mistake the next morning, Scully panicked and claimed his account had been hacked. He later admitted to the lie and was promptly suspended indefinitely. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but, you know, lying about something in a story like that, that really goes to the heart of being a journalist and being trustworthy. It's a very big thing for him to do that. He panicked. It was a mistake. It was a one-off mistake. As far as we know, he has a long, distinguished career. I don't know that this should kneecap him forever, but boy, is it a bad mistake. And the bigger mistake, why are you asking Anthony Scaramucci for advice about anything, much less how to deal with Trump? That doesn't make any sense. You know, that shows, you know, maybe he's his friend, but, you know, really?
Yeah,
Scaramucci to how to deal with Trump. Where does he have a track record of knowing how to deal with Trump?
Yeah, he did for 11 days, and then he got fired.
Yeah, exactly.
So my question is, you know, what made him feel that? And this is Scully. What made Scully feel that he needed to go and actually a respond in the first place?
Well, the president went public.
Yeah, why do you need to lie about it? Just say, yeah, I meant to send it as a direct message because I was looking for a little advice.
Well, because journalists are not supposed to turn to people they might report on for advice and information. They're not supposed to be your pal.
Yeah, well, all right. You know,
you're not all in bed together. You're supposed to be a little separate. They're not. And that's what this reveals. But you're right. He should have just said, it was a mistake. I should not have been reaching out to him. I apologize. But he panicked and lied. And that's not good.
Well, BTS, big deal or big whoop?
Big deal.
Yeah. Well, they are the South Korean boy band that's become a world-beating act of epic proportions. Although, shouldn't I be doing that in my Spider-Man?
No.
Okay. Their agency, Big Hit Entertainment, or BHE, to the cool folks. They have just launched an IPO, and it's BIG. You see what I did there? Company launched itself with a value of $4 billion, and that's billion with a B. By the end of the day, the company was worth $8 billion, and that is also B, billion with a B, okay? There's a lot of Bs in this story. That's a lot of fresh meat, by the way, okay? And sure, there's a Japanese reference for male pop culture stars, but hey, BTS is a worldwide phenomenon, so why not? Is the secret in the songs, the social media savvy, the adorable nature of the guys, and I'm looking at you, J-Hope, or is it the army, the fans who mobilize in ways large and small to keep them on top? And can Big Hit Entertainment leverage those fans for other acts? The stock market says yes, but what does the army say? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I don't think they can translate this to other acts, however. People are betting that BHE, Big Hit Entertainment, can do this again and again. They've got BTS. They're about to enter into the army, so that's going to be a problem. They're trying to stockpile songs and music and stuff, and they're hoping they'll be able to continue on social media while they're in the army for 2 years. Ideally, they'd like to make them their own platoon, and we could follow them as a reality show while they train and bunk together. That would be huge, but that's not going to happen. But they are going to have a 2-year pause, so that's a big looming problem. And the idea that the success they've had with the army with their fans can be translated to other acts or have that army support other people, that's a real lift. But as long as they got this band, as long as they're making money, and you see enough value in that, I think they're probably overvalued. Of course, that's probably safe to say right now. But yes, they're huge. How long will it last? We never know.
So there is mandatory military duty in South Korea, is what you're saying. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that is correct. And they have to do it by like the age of 25 or something. And they're saying, all right, we know this is coming. They're having them all go in together at the same time. Even though they wouldn't all have to, you know, you could wait an extra year or two for something. They figure just get it all over with the same time. So they're all going to enter at the same time. They're trying to stockpile all the creative content they have. They've gotten permission for them to have cell phones and be able to do social media while they're in the military, which I believe is new. They're doing everything they can to help try to keep their presence. The military is like, hey, this might be good for military morale. Let them show life in the military, and now they're proud patriots. So they're realizing, hey, this is not necessarily the worst thing. So let's bend the rules. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Well, our next story is about the Muscular Dystrophy Association. It is rebooting its Labor Day telethon in a way, in a whole new way, really. It's going to take place on YouTube. Because, you know, COVID, it will only last 2 hours. And the host is actor Kevin Hart. The comic star could use an image makeover after being disinvited from hosting the Oscars when people pointed out numerous anti-gay jokes he made. Remember that? Seems like 15 years ago at this point. Hart refused to apologize, walked away, and then apologized half-heartedly, I guess, on Ellen, if I recall correctly. Now he's wholly enthusiastic about taking over for Jerry Lewis, who used to do the Muscular Dystrophy telethon.
And now he's dead.
And now he can't do it anymore because, lady, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. You know, my immediate thought was, oh, you know, he could use an image makeover, Kevin Hart. This is a good way to do it. I hate to be cynical, but a lot of celebs devote their time to stuff like that. But hat tip to Hollywood Reporter and Gary Baum. They did a really good story, not only pointing that out, but pointing out the problems that the Muscular Dystrophy Association has, which I had no idea about. They have bad finances. They're getting poor ratings from those nonpartisan charity observers, those companies like Charity Navigator and Charity Watch. Charity Watch has downgraded it from an A level charity to a D. You get that based on how much money you take in and how much money goes out for the charity. At most, it should be like 10% of the money you bring in goes to operating expenses. They're at like 50%.
Wow.
So in 2019, they spent most of their money, 51%, on operating expenses. So they have a bad story to tell. Both of the charity raiders have given them very poor ratings. So they need to get their act together as well. So maybe they can do it together, but I'm not too excited about it. That's for sure.
My question is this, somewhat related, not related at all, by the way. When I did that Hey Lady bit right there, mm-hmm.
Well,
here's my question, because I made a joke about Max Headroom the other day, and everybody on the Zoom call, it was a business call, everybody kind of politely smiled, and you know, it was a joke about like the Zoom call breaking up, right?
Because Max Headroom.
Right, Max Headroom, yeah. And so I made this reference and everybody smiled and laughed. And I said, you know, I can always tell them my audience and like how old they are based on whether they understand that. And I said, did you guys understand that? And then there was like a long, long pause. And they went, yeah, no, we have no idea what you're referring to, Max Headroom. And I thought, oh, okay, so I'm just...
So you're younger than I think.
Yeah, I was like, and you're all... Yeah, okay.
You know, you can make a Who's On First joke, you can make a Charlie Chaplin joke, you can make a Napoleon joke, it doesn't matter. If they don't get it, they'll understand there's something there.
Okay, well, speaking of something being there, something is there that I didn't think would be there this year, and that is the Tony nominations, because... I didn't think they'd actually have any.
Sound like John Lovett suddenly.
I was like, how elliptical can I make this sentence? The Tony nominations for a drastically shortened season, by the way, they are out. Okay. Like I said, I didn't think they'd be there. And guess what? They are not surprising at all, since they had like four shows to choose from. For very few musicals, okay, opened up, and they almost all got nominated. So Sorry Percy Jackson, the musical, okay, which I did see off Broadway. Okay, I saw it when it was like in an alley somewhere in New York City. Mm-hmm. But only Jagged Little Pill, Moulin Rouge, and Tina, the Tina Turner musical, are considered simply the best. See what I did there?
I keep going.
Okay. By the way, which will win Best Musical? Well, first of all, you've got a 1 out of 3 chance in getting this right. So, you know, you've got a 30% chance of being right. As for best play, well, it will probably come down to the gay play, The Inheritance, the socially conscious work, Slave Play, or the good play, also known as The Sound Inside. I'm going with Slave Play because.
But yeah, probably going to win.
Yeah. But if you want a safe bet, place your money on Aaron. How do you pronounce this guy's name?
I think it's Tivet.
Okay. I mean, as I read about this thing, anyway. For best actor in a musical, he will win for Moulin Rouge. Why? He's the only nominee. Literally, they were like, and nominated for is Aaron Tivet. And our next category is like, they just, that's unbelievable. Aaron, you can't start working on your speech. Yeah, he actually can start working on his speech right about now. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, he still needs to campaign, because unless 60% of the voters tick off his box, he will not get a statue. So people who think it's ridiculous that there's only one nominee, or people who forget or think whatever, you got to tick that box or poor Aaron will be doubly humiliated. Imagine being the only nominee and losing. That would be really bad. That would be humiliating. So please, people, tick off your box. Give the guy a break. And jukebox musicals, you can tell they have come here in full force, because the best score nomination, where shows with songs would normally be, none of the musical nominees are there, because they're all based on pre-existing songs, like the album by Alanis Morissette, the career of Tina Turner, or in the case of Moulin Rouge, the entire history of pop music for the last 60 years. So that's it. There are no musical nominations. It's all plays getting nominated for best score. Very unusual to see. It's a crazy, weird year. Please vote for Aaron Tveit.
Isn't it ironic, don't you think?
Keep going.
You really ought to know, by the way. I got a million of
now,
these.
Do you think the people who are listening to the show know that? Should I tell them that's a rev? No, keep going.
The two talent agencies holding out in a deal with the Writers Guild of America loudly announced a deal was done that was way back in like September. Remember that? The WGA said, hey, not so fast, okay? And since then, they've been dragging their feet. The agencies, that is. The problem? The deal requires these agencies to limit their stake in production companies to 20%, and they can't agree on how to unwind those agreements. The WGA is ready to work with them, but grew frustrated. Now they've sent an open letter detailing ways the two agencies can get their stakes down to 20% and to end packaging, along with a request for more information on which the agencies have not, you know, by the way, the agencies have not been forthcoming at all, okay? So that's what the WGA wants. WME, William Morris Endeavor, says, let's wait until 2022 to reduce our stakes. CAA, Creative Artists Agency, they say, look, we're going to do it when it makes financial sense. In other words, no deadline on their ownership and on a schedule of their ownership. And the WGA has pretty much had enough wanting to make clear what is holding up the deal. It's not us, it's them. We're pointing fingers squarely in their direction. And we want to know, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. You remember when it was announced and everyone was like, you know, suddenly it was breaking news that they'd made a deal. We were like, oh, wow. And then like a few hours later, the WGA said, well, no, not really. Like, you haven't made it with us. And now it's weeks later and they still haven't done it. So clearly that was not a good faith gesture on the part of CA and WME. I don't know whether they thought the Writers Guild felt pressure to just sign something because they'd already announced it had happened, but it didn't work. And, you know, their offer is ridiculous. Well, we'll just get rid of it when we want to. It's like, well, no.
I understand that is often a clause in such negotiations, including, by the way, when there are acquisitions where a company, the acquiring company, has to get rid of certain assets. They say, okay, we'll do that, but we're going to do it.
They're not acquiring anybody.
Right. I'm just saying, but it's standard operating procedure to say, you can't force us to do this because then that lowers the value, but we will get rid of it, but we'll just do it when it is most financially beneficial to us. It might be tomorrow. It might be next week.
It might be never.
Well, that right. There should be a deal.
This is not a company acquiring another company or having to get rid of things because they need to meet government regulations. This is them signing a deal with the WGA, prematurely announcing a deal had been made and refusing to agree to one of the stipulations, which is that you must reduce your ownership in any production companies to 20%. You want to come with us with an idea telling us, well, we'll do it when we feel like it, is not an answer. No,
well, I definitely not a
standard,
understand.
This is not standard operating procedure. They're making a deal with them. They say this is one of our stipulations. And they said, no, we'll do it when we want to. We'll get back to you. Maybe never. That's not a reasonable thing.
Most of those standard operating procedures do have a deadline. You can sell any time before that deadline, meaning you can
They won't announce a deadline. Announce a deadline. Right. They're saying we'll do it when we want to and without any schedule. So don't try and pin us down. Well, that's ridiculous.
The deadline forces is that it will actually occur. The good news for the person selling is that, we're going to sell it right after we have a big hit. And then sell.
Yeah, if they want some wiggle room, of course. But 6 months, 8 months, when are you going to do it? They don't want to say. Maybe this is a little too inside baseball. I don't think so.
Oh, you know what? First of all, I hope you trust me with this transition. Okay, number one. Number two, if you mentioned inside baseball, it must be time for that segment. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Here's how this story will affect you this week. You are going to get a lot more content on Disney Plus. At least that is the assumption after the Walt Disney Company, under new CEO Bob Chapek, or as I think, Michael, you like to call him, Bob 2.
Or Bob 2.0, yeah.
Bob 2.0, yeah, because Bob Iger was the CEO, now it's Bob Chapek.
And Bob Iger, by the way, is still in charge. He's the boss of bosses. So he can pretend he's not there, but he is.
He tried to basically pull the whole chair. I'm just the chairman. It's like, yeah, but we're actually undergoing some rocky seas and some turbulence right now. So why don't you take back control of the airplane while we fly through this turbulence?
So we talked about Disney last week, and we're talking about them again this week. Why? Because they're kind of doing what we were just talking about that they might do. And it's a big deal, isn't it? What's going on?
So they basically said, here's what we're going to do. And I actually did a lot of research on this and spoke to a lot of people last week about this, because all the theater owners were like, oh my God, they're just going to make streaming content. They had all of these silos within Disney. They had the Hulu silo, like basically the television silo, right? All the TV channels and Hulu. Then they had the sports silo, all of ESPN and everything that had, you know, was related to ESPN. They had the theatrical silo, basically, you know, all the stuff that was going to movie theaters. And
they have,
and
ABC, they have the ABC silo, don't they?
Well, that's the network silo. That falls into television.
Well, right, but is that Hulu or is that separate? It's different people making those decisions, isn't it?
No, it was Peter Rice. So it was basically
television and Hulu. And there's the Disney Plus silo.
And then here comes the Disney Plus silo. And there was and by the way, they all have their own distribution arms to each one of them. So they'd be making the content and distributing the content. So what Disney decided after a year of basically Kevin Mayer, when he was there running Disney Plus, fighting with Peter Rice, who was in charge of all the TV stuff. And basically Peter Rice was saying, I get to decide what content goes to Hulu and what you can have, Disney Plus, because all this content is coming my way first. And Disney Plus said, wait a second, no, we get to decide. It's Disney Plus first, and then maybe we have Hulu. And Bob Chapek said, I'm putting an end to this. First off, Kevin Mayer, you get to decide. Disney Plus it is, okay? So Disney Plus won that fight, okay? Which kind of put Peter Rice in an awkward position. And then you had, of course, movies going, oh, what about us? We're still kind of cool, aren't we? And so you had all this infighting. And so what Disney decided to do was they said,
I thought,
okay,
you said they just resolved it by saying it was Rice.
Here's what they decided to, Mayer. They decided Mayer is getting to decide. Then they decided, you know what? Here's what we're doing. Disney Plus, you're going to make content. Okay. Hulu, you're going to make content. And television, you're going to make content. And the theatrical division, Buena Vista, you're going to make content for theatrical and legacy, what they called legacy platforms. Love that phrase, legacy platforms. That's just wonderful. But you're all going to be making content in your own little fiefdoms. Then it will be decided by a completely different division how that content will be distributed.
What the hell? You're describing exactly the opposite of what I believe they've done.
No.
They're saying we're getting rid of all the silos. We're going to have one person in charge, and then we'll decide where the content goes.
One person in charge of distribution, not in charge of deciding what gets made and how it gets made. Now, how it gets distributed, that's a different story. That's what's on the one fiefdom.
Well, what you're saying, ESPN Plus is going to greenlight something, but it may end up not being on ESPN?
Correct.
How does that make any sense? How is that a better improvement on what they were doing?
Well, I think really what
I think it's just like, we're making content. It may go to the theater. It may go to Disney Plus. It may go to ABC. It may go to Hulu. It may go to ESPN, but let's put all content under one roof. That was my understanding. Whether it's an animated film for Disney or it's an animated TV series that's going to be on the Disney Channel, or an animated thing that's going to be on Disney Plus, or a documentary that goes on Hulu or ESPN, we've got one roof and one group of people. We're not making these big silos and these big distinctions. We're making content, and it may go to any of those sources, but we're making content under one roof. So there's one decision-making process and not 27 of them with their own little fiefdoms. That's my understanding.
Yes and no. And that's what was, was very confusing for people. Okay.
Well, what was confusing is that they made the decision, but it kind of looked like smoke and mirrors. We know this was not done last week in response to some pressure from investors. We know they clearly must have had this in mind for a while. That's what it seems like. However, the announcement was half-assed and confusing. It's an unclear corporate structure, as we've just made clear. There are a lot of missing names in terms of who's the top talent and who's in charge of what and who reports to whom, which is very important. To quote Variety, internally, employees at Disney across the board were left puzzled by both the timing and the contents of the announcement. Various power hubs were announced with great fanfare, but it wasn't immediately clear if the likes of Alan Horn and Alan Bergman, who rule over the company's film effort, TV chief Peter Rice, who was named chairman of general entertainment content, and sports chief James Pitaro, the chairman of ESPN and sports content, were being promoted or just playing similar roles with a slightly greater mandate to think more in terms of what's binge-worthy. Quote, said another exec, this is weird. End quote. They're just puzzled and confused.
I think in part they're also trying to They're trying to take the control away from creatives as well, because if you're Christopher Nolan, we now have seen that you can force the studio to distribute your film theatrically, even if it would be...
This has nothing to do with having a... Doesn't matter what restructuring a studio does. If you're dealing with Spielberg or Nolan or one or two other filmmakers or Peter Jackson, you're not going to dictate to them. James Cameron, you're not going to push them around. None of this has anything to do with that.
Creatives on that level, but that's...
Well, that's what you just did. You said Christopher Nolan. Nolan, Spielberg, okay. Peter Jackson. You're not pushing them around. So okay, this has nothing to do with that.
Let's take filmmaker X, who's not any of those big names.
Let's not. This has nothing to do with pushing filmmakers around. This is due with them having 17 different silos for content and saying this: we've got a stupid corporate structure. Everybody's competing with each other. Nobody knows who can give the final green light or the final answer. We need to streamline and make clear who's in charge. But what they failed to do was streamline it and make clear who's in charge. That's why we're arguing about what's going on, because we're all confused. To continue quoting Variety, with the emphasis on streaming and refocusing the company's orientation on content creation, many in the industry were surprised at the lack of mention of prominent creative execs in this big reorganization.
I was surprised
Dana Walden.
Yeah.
Right. The chair of Disney Television Studios and ABC Entertainment, not to mention FX Network boss John Landgraf. Where do they fit into this? So this is a half-assed, confused, messy restructuring that they did not think through properly. And they clearly did rush a little bit thanks to that investor stuff. But they're not the only ones. ITV, a major TV player in the UK, they also announced they're doing a restructuring to focus on streaming and on demand. They're also reducing the imprint of their London offices. They're going to have few people in their London offices because of the pandemic. So there's a lot going on here. But you know what I would say? Is it an overreaction to the pandemic? Maybe a little bit, you know? But I think if you say, oh, Disney is moving away from cinemas, they've been dominating theatrical. Last year, they had 40% of the domestic market, probably just as much, if not more, of the worldwide market. They've been making so much money at theatrical, and now they're saying, oh no, we're all panicked because they may be de-emphasizing theatrical. Guess what? They've been doing that for years. Last year, they released 6 films, if you don't count their Earth Day movie, which we don't even know the budget for. They released 6 films: Dumbo, Aladdin, Toy Story 4, The Lion King, Maleficent 2, and Frozen 2. That's it.
Of course, there would be some that say Lucasfilm released a movie. And then, of course, you have, Pixar, I think you've thrown in there, right? Frozen.
Yes.
Toy Story 4, yes. So you have Marvel, of course. You have the Marvel mm-hmm. film. So there would be some that might push back on that a little bit, that their theatrical, certainly the distribution side of the equation would say, hey, we worked on more than 6 movies last year.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And you look at those movies, a live action remake, the fourth movie in a series, a live action remake. The second probably last movie in a franchise, Maleficent, and the second perhaps last in a franchise, Frozen 2. You know, they're really warming over old stuff here. You know, Disney, you know, I feel like they're the king of the world right now, but they're not so much.
What is it with you and James Cameron these days?
Well, this horrible announcement, so confusing, so many execs not accounted for, no clarity on what's going on to the point where you and I can't even agree on what they said. This is not good. This does not reflect well on Bob 2.0, Bob Chapek. This is a bungle. It's confusing, and I don't like it.
Well, yeah, I think you stand amongst the many. I think a lot of people felt that way. I was really surprised Dana Walden wasn't mentioned at all.
Yeah, well, and John Landgraf, says John Landgraf. What about me?
He says, you know what? He didn't say anything. He said, how do you spell vitae? Is there an E in vitae? That's a curriculum vitae joke. How many curriculum vitae jokes do you get in life? Come on.
How many in other podcasts? None.
That's right. And
do they end with obituaries?
Yeah, come on. We're the only podcast around that ends in an obituary. Let's talk about some sad news, like the fact that, is it Conchita or Conchata Ferrell?
I think it's Conchata.
Well, she died at the age of 77. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because you're a fan of 2.5 Men, of which she was neither. She was
I'm not. Yeah, she wasn't two men or a half a man, but she was probably the best thing on the show. I certainly never liked the show, but she was actually, you know, funny. And she was an accomplished stage actress with Circle Rep in New York City. She starred in 5 different sitcoms. She was Emmy nominated for a performance on L.A. Law. She's got a good run of movies, Mystic Pizza, Aaron Brockovich, Edward Scissorhands. But of course, she's best known for her twice nominated turn as the housekeeper in 2 and a Half Men. A welcome presence on the air for all those years. I know Mark Berman, our friend from Programming Insider. We've had him on the show before talking about TV. He was a big fan of Contrada Ferro. He said, you know, she just was a terrific actress. So a shame to see.
Well, another person who will not be getting one day more is Herbert Kretzmer, who died at the age of 95. Come on,
well,
that was pretty
well
good.
Done.
That
well
was pretty
done.
Good. I pulled that one out of my, well, I'm not going to say where I pulled it out of, but come on.
Well done.
He is the lyricist for Les Mis, thus the one day more reference. And, you know, he had quite the career. He worked with Charles Aznavour. He was a journalist as well. Like, wow.
For many years, he was a big journalist, yes. And he wrote a novelty tune called Goodness Gracious Me with Peter Sellers and Sophie or Loren. They had a hit with that. He wrote several West End plays, but on his tombstone are the English language lyrics for Les Mis. He will live on that forever. And he met his wife at like the opening night party. So, you know, everything good to him came from Les Mis.
Well, and think also, about it. I mean, what kind of better pickup line do you have than, hey, what are you doing here? I wrote all the lyrics to the musical you just watched. I mean, that's a good pickup line in any case.
I think the guys who worked on him, the French people, were not happy with the attention he got, and they resisted working with him on Miss Saigon and some other shows. They eventually did work with him again, but there was a few years where they avoided it, and I think it was to their detriment.
Now, also dying was Rhonda Fleming at the age of 97. She was discovered by agent Henry Wilson and signed by a guy named David Selznick. Does that name sound familiar?
Yes, it does indeed.
He was a real 20th century fox, that Selznick.
She was a stunner. Red hair, green eyes. She looked good from every angle. There's a myth or a story that, you know, a cinematographer tried to find a bad angle for her. Above, below, it's this side, that side. Let, you know, see if Barbara Streisand, no, it's not my good side. There was no bad side for Rhonda Fleming. She was a stunner, but she was a good talent too. And Henry Wilson, her agent, he was a big guy. He signed Rock Hudson, Natalie Wood, Tab Hunter. She probably felt safe with him as her agent. You know, he was never going to hit on her. No casting couch there. She was in Hitchcock's Spellbound as a nymphomaniac, and boom, she was off to the races after that. 6 husbands. And, you know, you love cinema, Sperling. Ending up with exhibitor Ted Mann of Mann's Chinese. She was with him from 1978 until he died in 2001. So they had 23 years together.
Wow.
She was also in the John Sturges Western Gunfight at the OK Corral. She did movies with both Hope and Crosby, including a Connecticut Yankee. But best of all, really, are her roles in noirs, film noir, While the City Sleeps, Cry Danger, and the masterpiece Out of the Past. What a great film that is. If you've never seen it, do check it out. She's great in it. And also dying this week is the record label founder, Bob Biggs. He founded Slash back in 1978. He died at 74. He ran that company Slash from 78, sold it to, you know, bigger labels eventually, but he kept running it until it collapsed in 1996. Then he bought the name back again and turned it into a reissue label. But for 20 years, when he was on top, it was one of the coolest and most influential labels around. They started with a 7-inch single from the punk band The Germs. Good way to start. They also had X, the band X, Dream Syndicate, Faith No More, The Blasters, great live band, Violet Femmes, L7, and best of all, Los Lobos. That is a great, great band. So a cool legacy for Slash. For a while there, if you saw it on Slash, you knew it was worth buying.
Well, and we hope we've been worth listening to this week, because we are now at the end of our program for today. You can subscribe to our show in the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us, you can rate and review us in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as those ways to subscribe to us, those can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to write to us and contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can like our page. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's willthewolfsurvive.com. That's an old Los Lobos reference, and that's available. Los Lobos, however, I'm having trouble connecting. I assume they have a website, loslobos.com, but if you never heard them, that first EP, Will the Wolves Survive, that's the place to start. And then go to Kiko.
And then, you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website,
and you won't,
why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com? And of course, what's going on with Bookfilter, by the way? Do we want to talk about that?
Bookfilter's dead.
What? Okay.
Dead.
We'll have to discuss that. You know what? We're going to do something that I hear a lot in Zoom meetings. We're going to take that offline, as they say. you know what? Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.